The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
But it was sort of piecing this together off of various videos because we didn't have any context. But we knew now, okay, there was this incident that he was involved in. What he had said in the paperwork that day is that he was punched and then hit with a pole. And that's sort of what he had described to his wife as well, that he was hit and then also he got hit with a pole later that night. There are two sort of separate incidents. And so from there, they were able to identify a DC chiropractor who was wearing this distinctive jacket, this motorcycle jacket, when he stormed the Capitol, which was sort of surprising because, you know, you wouldn't imagine someone who lived a couple blocks from the Capitol getting sucked into this. But he was just sort of in that conspiracy world and had posted things about, you know, the election and it being stolen, was a big sort of COVID denier. And so he had, you know, even done an interview, I think, a man on the street interview the day after January 6th, talking with a reporter about how he was on the steps. Didn't say he was inside, of course, but he was really deep in the Capitol. And they used facial recognition initially with that hit and then found all this confirming information, including the jacket.
I'm Roger Parloff, senior editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, November 14th, 2023. Last month, an amazing new book came out about the prosecutions stemming from the January 6th Capitol siege. It's called Sedition Hunters: How January 6th Broke the Justice System. I sat down with the book's author, Ryan J. Riley, who is also the justice reporter at NBC News. We discussed who the sedition hunters are, how Ryan stumbled across them, and why they've played such a crucial role in the January 6th investigation. It's the Lawfare podcast, November 14, Ryan J. Riley on the Sedition Hunters.
Before we get to the book, let me just get a little background about you. Ryan J. Riley, where are you from and what did you do before you became a justice reporter for the NBC News?
So actually, I was from New Jersey originally, and I always sort of knew I wanted to cover the Capitol. So I went here for college, and then afterwards I graduated in 09, so not the best market to graduate into for looking for a gig. But I ended up getting sort of an initial job at Bloomberg, worked on a research project there, sort of a temporary thing. And then I saw a posting for a job at this website that no longer exists called Main Justice. And it covered the Justice Department. And the way I sort of got through the vetting process for that gig was that I knew the name of the Attorney General as opposed to some people who had interviewed who didn't.
Oh my.
So that's sort of what got me stuck. That's sort of what got me sucked into the justice world. And I've been covering it sort of ever since.
Yeah, that's a deep bit of experience to draw upon.
Yeah, yeah.
So the book is Sedition Hunters: How January 6th Broke the Justice System. It's by Public Affairs. So who are the Sedition Hunters and how did you first learn that such a group existed?
It actually started for me with a Twitter joke. There was this video of Rachel Powell, and she was – at the time, no one knew what her name was, but she was known online as Bullhorn Lady. And there's this video of her sort of on a bullhorn, obviously, hence the name Bullhorn Lady, going through the broken window, sort of talking with other rioters in this tone that you sort of strike up with children. It was almost like she was sort of, you know – chaperoning a field trip to the insurrection. And she said, you know, okay, guys, if you want to take the Capitol, we're going to have to work together. And so I made some joke about how the, you know, $20 says this results in not only criminal charges, but a PTA resignation. and there shortly thereafter, I ended up getting a message from an individual I now know as Forrest Rogers, who's really the only named sleuth in the book. And he had identified this person working with a team called, you know, Deep State Dogs is what they called themselves. And that's because Forrest has a little puppy of his own. He's a big dog fan. So they had identified them. We're trying to this individual, and we're trying to figure out what to do with that information. So that's sort of what got me initially in the door. And then sort of stories sort of fell out from there. And the first big story that we worked on together after Ronan Farrow kind of scooped me with the Rachel Powell story involved Danny Rodriguez, who was the individual who drove the stun gun into Mike Fanone's neck, the D.C. Metropolitan Police officer on January 6th. And he was known as Taser Prick. And after our initial story in February of 2021, the FBI busted in the sliding glass door in his backyard a month later.
So you did a story about him before he was arrested?
Correct, yeah.
And did you name him?
We did.
How did your NBC lawyers react to that?
I was at HuffPost at the time.
Oh, I'm...
Yeah, and I think that in those initial days, I think there was a lot more of a reason to be naming people who weren't arrested yet. And I have a different position on that now, in that, like, now, in fact, just this week, there's someone, in fact, today when we're recording this, there's someone in New Jersey who the FBI went to go arrest, and he's now on the run and can't be found. And this is an individual who was identified more than a year and a half ago. So it becomes a little bit more complicated when you have, you know, this notion of they might flee, that might make law enforcement's job more difficult. And like, I kind of have more complicated feelings about that now. But initially for these stories, I think like getting those names out there and, you know, sort of spurring action when the FBI was buried in these cases, there was a journalistic sort of imperative to do so and tell these stories of, you know, before they sort of fell through the cracks, because the Bureau was just overwhelmed with the number of tips that they had received. So it was a little bit of a slog to get it through the lawyers, but it wasn't also that bad, because we had people willing to say, I know who, you know, this person is, and I'm confirming that this is him in the video. And, you know, you could just confirm it with all of the various materials and pins that were on his hat. Hmm. This, you know, it wasn't a huge secret that this guy was a huge Trump fan, had this unique look, these unique hats, and then there he was on video committing the crime.
Yeah. And I should say that, you know, I've in the course of my own reporting, I've met, you know, a few reporters that are really steeped in these cases, you know, but you are one of the very few that is steeped in the cases that haven't been charged yet. You know, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
And that's a unique thing. Now, was there somebody that was sort of first among equals among the sedition hunters?
You know, I think that from the get-go, they sort of self-policed a little bit themselves. There's certainly still a divergence of opinions. There's people who don't get along within the community. But early on, they sort of all did agree upon the rules in terms of not naming people on social media and vetting these cases either by sending them into the FBI or by working with journalists. And that was something they sort of all got around, because we saw how this played out really poorly, this sort of online research, this online, you know, this online investigating in the Boston Marathon bombing, when people were falsely accused of being associated with that horrific crime. So that was something that I think everyone was sort of on the same page on immediately. You know, now
it's really important. I mean, it's sort of remarkable that this group was so responsible, so self-policing, like you say.
Yeah. Yeah, it really isn't, because that's, you know, how things can just go really haywire. And that's also what I think has built up this trust with the Bureau, where the nice thing is, because this is all open source information that the sleuths are turning in, is that the FBI can vet this themselves. And, you know, the easiest way for them to do that often to confirm that, hey, this person actually did go inside the Capitol, is to just check their geofence warrant for all the phone numbers of people who went into the Capitol that day. Easy way, or just, you know, check their credit card statements. There are a number of ways to confirm this, but they can also just vet the open source information on their own and look at it and say, yes, this, I can see how you followed this thread. I can see that, where this checks out.
One of the guys that seems to be among the most important is a guy you call Alex in the book. Can you talk a little about him and his app?
Yeah. So, you know, there are a number of these sort of tools that were built in the aftermath, including some of them that were publicly available online for people to search through materials. But, you know, Alex, I think, really did play a critical role here in helping everyone organize behind the scenes. And I think the easiest way that I've sort of talked about this to describe what you can do is to think of, you know, go to your iPhone. And if you go to any photo on your iPhone and you swipe up, and if it's of your kids or it's of your family members, everyone will have their own little bubble. Everyone will have their own little face. And then you click on that and it'll show you everyone, every photo of that individual in your gallery. And that's essentially one of the things that I think the SLUs have been able to do really well is get all of this material together in one database and then search it relatively easily using internal facial recognition. So there's the internal facial recognition that just brings up these images very quickly. And then there's the external component of it, which is that they're using sites like PimEyes to identify people in the real world who were there at the Capitol on January 6th. But they don't –
I don't know what that PimEyes is.
Yeah. So PimEyes is this – it's this tool that basically you can put your photo into it and then it'll find any photos of you online. So for me personally, it's creepy.
For how me, do you spell that?
PimEyes, P-I-M-E-Y-E-S.
I see.
Yeah. And there's other websites that do something similar, but you know, this is only about $1 a day, like $30 a month. I think you get 25 searches a day. And what you and for me, it turns up a bunch of photos of me on Capitol Hill questioning lawmakers, like photos I've never seen before. Some photos I probably wish didn't exist. They're just bad angles. And, you know, there are images of me. Even if half of my face is covered, it'll pick me up. Even if I'm wearing a face mask during the COVID-19 pandemic, it's still got me.
Oh, my God.
Sunglasses. It's got me in before when I've been outside. So it really does like do a really tremendous job. But the SLUs don't rely on that alone. They always have that sort of confirming other information. So they'll find an item of clothing. So, you know, there's the one case I talk about with Logan Barnhart, who was found with the app. And he was a former bodybuilder who was working in construction in Michigan when he stormed the Capitol or tried to storm the Capitol and dragged a police down the stairs. And he was pretty well covered up. So nothing was turning up for him at first when they were entering these photos. And then there's one image that he was actually at the Ellipse during President Trump's speech. And it's just a very quick video. Someone very quickly pans over the crowd, but he's standing right there. And in that case, he had his sunglasses sort of strapped to his shirt as opposed to on his face, gave them the full face shot. Then they ended up running PimEyes, I believe, used on that. And then it turned up all of these romance novels where he was the cover model of. And then they sort of worked backwards from there, found all of these images of him working in these various bodybuilding competitions and went from there. So it really is pretty useful.
And Alex, it turns out, voted for Trump.
Alex did vote for Trump. And that was a little twice, bit of a surprise.
Twice,
yeah, the second time too. He was not a fan of Hillary Clinton, but he is one of those swing Obama-Trump voters that you hear so much about. I think he's a successful guy. So I think a lot of this was just sort of economics for him.
And he was a tech guy or a software guy.
Exactly. Yeah.
So does the DOJ still not have such an app?
Not that I'm aware of. I think they have something that they're using, but it's not, I think, as high tech. They're still very much so relying on the SLUs for a lot of this.
That's amazing.
And even, personally for me, it's like a lot of this I now have, you know, saved all these videos that come out through the court process. I have these all saved. I have them on my own computer, on my own, you know, sort of network. And then, but like in order to, even if I remember a video, then I have to think back, okay, what case was this associated with? I'm not going to remember that. What, you know, how do I pull it up? It's just a lot easier way to surface these videos if you can just like, you know, if you have it organized in a way like photo, your iPhoto library, for example.
I see. How many sedition hunters are there, would you say?
You know, it's tough to put a number on. I think in the early days, I mean, dozens is usually sort of the default that I go to. I mean, in the early days, there were a lot more people who are deeply involved day to day. I think now there's more of a core group who it's boiled down to. And, you know, the IDs are still coming in, but the thing that always still shocks people when I say, when I tell them, is that there are 1,000 people who could be arrested who have not yet been arrested right now who are identified. That's just the people who are identified. The FBI has right now 1,000 names of people who have not yet been arrested, who either stormed the Capitol, who assaulted law enforcement officers outside, or who engaged in property damage. The total number of people who could be arrested, that's add another 1,000 onto that. So it's more than 3,000 is the total scope, but there's a lot of those who haven't been identified yet. And so that, though, you know, there's 1,000 people still to identify, but those ones are the ones that are a little bit tougher, I think, to break through, at least for the SLUs, based on what they have publicly available.
Mm-hmm. The FBI from time to time has asked you not to publish names. Is that right? And and the SLUs themselves, right?
Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, been – I mean, I've thought through this a lot, right? At the beginning of – especially in 2021, at some point, it was not a January 6th case, I should say. But there was an instance where FBI agents were shot and killed. And I think that that has been something that's been hanging in my brain ever since.
Oh, wow.
And like the last thing that I would want is for me to write a story, you know, and get some, you know, oh, it gets great. It's a fun story for a day. But then that causes something to happen, or that causes someone to be prepared for something. And we've seen instances, you know, there was a January 6th defendant in Texas who found out that the FBI was arresting him. It's unclear why, but his case was not sealed to begin with, as most of these cases are. It was just publicly filed on the docket. He got a phone call, found out, and went into this spiral and ended up shooting at police officers when they showed up to his house.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, a lot of these people, especially who believe sort of bizarre conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, aren't the most mentally stable folks. And I think that, you know, that's sort of something that I've had hanging in my head, is that we want to make sure we prioritize safety, right, over our, sort of everything else. And I think especially at this point, now that we're almost 3 years into this investigation, the names, I think, especially for the more violent offenders, is like not necessarily something that you need to – I think there are, I should say, I have done other stories since, but it's been those more misdemeanor cases where they're a public figure of some consequence, right? So there was an elected official in Connecticut who stormed the Capitol, and that was something that there's a public interest there. But, you know, it's I think there's definitely a balance that you have to sort of play out when you decide on these cases.
For sure. To get back to there is a scary aspect about, you know, having these citizens out there. You know, you could imagine, you know, Project Veritas people having some sort of project of their own. I mean, quality control is so important.
Yeah.
And do they sort of exclude some people who want to help, or do they just sort of ignore? How does that work?
I think they vetted the people who – but it's interesting because, you know, they don't even know each other a lot of the time, right? But they know each other's track records, and they know – like, so even if you don't know who a person is, which is in my case with a number of the SLUs, I know them just by their handle, but I know what their history is, and I can also check their work. So, you know, these are people now who I've been working with for more than 2 years. Who, and if someone, you know, if someone with some handle comes to me and I'm like, oh yeah, I know this person, I know, you know, their history, I can trust them on this, and they can show me their work, and I can check it out and vet it myself, and which is really, really helpful. That's the great thing about this open source world, is that you're not placing your full trust into anonymous people online. You can check the math, so to speak.
Do they communicate with one another just like using hashtags over Twitter, or do they have Signal chats or Telegram or what?
A lot of it's behind the scenes now. So Discord is a big platform where they all sort of organize and talk to each other. And yeah, that's – and most of it's happening behind the scenes, and then there's the public-facing component of it. But what we've seen more recently, especially after that first year, and I had written about this at the time, as we got into 2022, you saw a little bit of a pivot in terms of, okay, they've already identified these people, and now it's a little bit about putting public pressure on the FBI to make sure that they bring it home. Mm-hmm. That was the case of an individual in Long Island who is the co-owner of a funeral home that he inherited from his family, and stormed the Capitol with his son, who was also an employee at the funeral home. He used wasp spray to assault officers that day. I don't believe that they got inside, but he assaulted officers with wasp spray is what he's been charged with now.
There was a guy named Chris, or maybe it's a woman named Chris. you're ambiguous about that. But that person eventually, he's a sedition hunter. And eventually they really develop a relationship with the FBI and they get some compensation.
You know, I'm not sure the scope of the what we know from the affidavit is that there's something there. But like also it could have just been reimbursements. You know, I don't want to say, you know, if it's I don't know. I haven't asked Chris what level of I just knew that from the sort of a public filing. But that was really – yes. So they are this key sort of middle man or middle woman in this role where basically a lot of things are funneled through them. And they would be – they've said that, you know, they would be willing to testify if necessary in any of these cases. The thing is that I think unless a defense attorney really pushes this issue, there's really no reason for them to have to testify because you can vet all this information on its own and you can verify it in various other ways without relying upon someone who basically played sort of this role in bringing a lot of this information from the SLUs to the FBI. But – when I met them in late 2021, they were very much so surprised by how big of a role they were playing. And they knew they were playing a big role, but the scope of it, I think, really took them aback. And there's this moment. And some of this is just like – I remember it happening and I just was like, you can't write this, right? So they are sitting there and they're wearing a like a detective hat and they're sitting there. And they mouth, like talking about how big of an impact that they had, they mouth huge, like in this almost Trumpian fashion. And I'm just I, after leaving that, I'm just like writing down. Yep, okay, yeah. Like it's just so many of these things that you're like, you can't write this. It really is incredible how much of an impact I think that the SLUs have had, and hundreds of names still to come.
There was one case that I was aware of as it was happening, just in terms of the results. We were together watching the Proud Boys trial from the media room in the courthouse, and just to explain to the readers if they don't remember, you know, that five people are on trial, and at the top three defendants are obviously very crucial, Enrique Tarrio and Ethan Nordine and Joe Biggs. But then the next one, Zach Real, seemed like a notch below, and his lawyer was doing an effective job of making it sound like he was in a different category and emphasizing he's not charged with assault, he's not charged with destroying property, you know, not he didn't break a window or throw a water bottle. And he elects to take the stand during the defense case. And the direct ends on a Friday night evening. And he has testified, yes, I never assaulted anybody. I never broke any, you know, I never destroyed any property. Take it from there. The direct ends, and we know that on Monday, the government will start its cross.
Yeah, so it was this long weekend, and the attorney in that case was essentially trying to burn time, I remember, because you didn't want the jury to go into the long weekend with prosecutors having the last word.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so what happened – so basically it was a very sort of slow day getting through these questions, asking questions sort of repeatedly in different ways and not really not literally learning anything new. It wasn't the most exciting, I think, Thursday or Friday or whatever it was. And then bring in the long weekend. And then as they come back, suddenly there's new information that the prosecution has that the defense only learned about just before, probably 10 minutes before this cross-examination happened. And this wasn't something that the government withheld. It was something that the government didn't know about and hadn't found within their own discovery. It was also, you know, video was also buried in, I think, the discovery that was available to the defense. But I mean, without getting too deep in the weeds, you're not going to typically be in a situation where a defense attorney is going to put someone on the stand knowing that they assaulted a law enforcement officer, but that the government doesn't know about that yet, right? Like this was a situation where Zachary Real kept that information to himself, where he knew what he had done, pointing that pepper spray can, but he did not disclose that to his defense attorney. He did not, and the prosecution didn't know about it. So he was this close to getting away with that, right? And he still wasn't charged or even convicted of that. It was used as in sentencing to heighten his sentence a little bit. But that explicit attack, he was not charged with. And so, you know, they get to question him and they show him this video and he just sort of falls apart on the stands and on the stand. And he defaulted to the answer about whether he assaulted anyone. He said, "Not that I recall," which is oof, just one of those moments where you're like, okay, pretty sure that's something you remember, bud, but okay.
Yeah, that was an amazing moment. Oh, yes. And with that one, of course, it was crucial. By that point, they have a relationship with the government so that they can get the information to them. I imagine in the beginning, reaching the government is not an easy thing. You know, they're over.
Yeah.
Over.
I mean, they've taken to using email addresses for assistant U.S. attorneys now. They've like set up so they get this information. They make sure it gets to them. A lot of the sleuths do have these contacts directly at the FBI now. But what you were seeing in these early days was just this getting dumped into this database. And just think for a moment about getting hundreds of thousands of tips. It's hopeless. It really is. Even if you need to set up some sort of mechanism to get through those in a timely fashion, and there's still the rest of the world happening. So it's not as though, you know, the FBI stopped having to deal with, you know, school shooter threats and whatnot that were coming into the National Threat Office. They just got a whole bunch of these tips that are sitting in a database somewhere that most of them haven't been sorted through. Often I'll see cases now where the sleuths will have pushed the FBI on something, but instead of relying on the sleuths, they'll just go back and they'll find in the database from 2 years ago, oh yeah, like one of their, you know, college friends or something, or their high school friends turned them in, or a classmate or something like that, and base the entire case off of that, and then use the open source stuff as well.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I
found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before DeleteMe started advertising with Lawfare. DeleteMe finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then DeleteMe comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
The first I became aware of these guys, it was just, I would be tweeting, you know, live tweeting, and the prosecutor would mention a new name I hadn't heard of that wasn't a, you know, wasn't a defendant, and I would misspell it. And then I would instantly get, you know, a reply with the correct spelling plus 20 to 30 photographs and video links, and I began to get the picture. One thing I noticed, though, initially it put me off, but you explain it in the book. There's these sort of usually nasty nicknames that they have for each person, you know, like Taser Prick or Pink Beret or Bullhorn Lady.
Yeah.
But those actually serve a purpose, you explain.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that the FBI hasn't identified a lot more people on their list, because think of it from a journalist's perspective. Right now, if you go to the FBI's Capital Violence website, you're going to see 540-something in that range, over 500. But if you just like add a photo of someone at the Capitol, and it's maybe just like two still shots of them, so you don't really know what they were doing, and you say, hey, we're looking for information on number 537, it's not going to get any media attention. I can't write a story on that.
Yeah.
Like I don't even know what the headline would be. Yeah. There's just not a lot of information to go off of. But, you know, if you give this a nickname, it helps you remember it. It also helps it stand out. And, you know, it's just something that it's a lot easier to remember that than, oh, number 259 or whatever their AFO or assault on a federal officer number is that the FBI gives them. And I really can't imagine anything for that, the non-nickname policy, other than sort of politics, because, I mean, they do that with bank robbers all the time. They give them these goofy nicknames and they get all of this local media coverage and people get identified off of that. But like, how do you think Jim Jordan would feel about the them giving nicknames to people in a MAGA hat, right? Like right. It just gets real dicey real quick. Right. But like, you know, the ones that have gotten the most attention are kind of the funnier ones. Pink Beret is an example of that, mm-hmm. where the FBI added this person with a Pink Beret. And it just went super viral. Everyone was making fun of it. Everyone was coming up with these nicknames about it. On the one hand, you had people who thought the FBI was, you know, overreaching. On the other hand, it's just sort of, you know, you had both the left and the right sort of like talking about this. It got a ton of views. It blew up. And the way this person was identified is because two guys are standing in line at a Joann Fabrics with a guy getting a part for his sewing machine. He's a clothing designer. And his buddy's looking at his phone on Twitter and says, check this out. shows it over to him, and the friend looks, and it's his ex-girlfriend.
Oh, my God.
So then they turn that in. He turns it into the FBI, ended up speaking with him afterwards, and he had all of this, you know, information identifying her, and then she was subsequently charged. She's living overseas, so has not been arrested yet, but she's been charged by name. And I should say her now husband has also been charged because he was involved in some of the assaultive conduct there.
Oh, wow. And so you know a lot of people that have not been arrested that were involved. You understand in most cases why they haven't been arrested yet?
No. No, I think there's a variety of different reasons and none of them are usually satisfying. I mean, there definitely is a political element to this where there are field offices that just aren't that enthusiastic about January 6th cases. Varying levels of enthusiasm is the way one law enforcement official sort of diplomatically described it to me. But, you know, we have a number of these quote-unquote whistleblowers who have come forward now and have made these little media careers off of disparaging the FBI's work on January 6th cases. You know, people have quit over these cases. So I think and if you just look at the people, the feeders into the FBI, it makes sense. I mean, you know, if you were to go back to the year 2015 and say the FBI is this liberal haven, people would look at you crazy, right? We've gotten this sort of now expectation because of the sort of these relentless attacks, I think, from Donald Trump, as well as some mistakes that the Bureau has made and some information that's come out, you know, in these Inspector General reports and whatnot of the FBI. But it's just like a little bit – it's a lot different from, you know, what I think this idea that's being sort of batted around by Donald Trump and in the media is, because, you know, it's a generally still a conservative-leaning organization. It's a law enforcement organization. So I sort of think of it as more sort of like, you know, center-right, if anything.
Yeah. The sedition hunters also got involved in one civil case in a sense. This was the case of Jeff Smith's wife, or Jeff Smith. Talk about that.
Yeah, so that was really sort of wild. The way that this started was that I written a story about the sedition hunters, and one of the readers happened to be married and law partners with a lawyer who was representing the widow of Jeffrey Smith, who died by suicide 9 days after the January 6th attack. And she was really struggling, and the family was struggling to get information on what exactly happened to Officer Smith that day, because they were sort of being stonewalled by the Metropolitan Police Department. And so they asked sort of the sleuths to get to work to find him in the footage of that day. And it took a while, but they eventually found, using the number that he was wearing and using a photo that was provided, they eventually found him and said, okay, here's where he was. And from there, we're able to get various angles on that initial sort of squabble that he got into with these riders as they were trying to push these riders. I should give a little more context. After Ashley Babbitt was shot and killed, they were trying to push all of these riders out of the Capitol. Jeffrey Smith was in that fray, and there are two individuals who are close to him. One of them was holding a weaponized cane, and there's this moment where he sort of goes down in the crowd. And so
a weaponized cane, meaning
So it's a cane, but it has like an edge to it. It's meant to be used as a weapon. You know, so there was these two individuals. But it was sort of piecing this together off of various videos because we didn't have any context. But we knew now, okay, there was this incident that he was involved in. What he had said in the paperwork that day is that he was punched and then hit with a pole, and that's sort of what he had described to his wife as well, that he was hit and then also he got hit with a pole later that night. There are two sort of separate incidents. And so from there, they were able to identify a DC chiropractor who was wearing this distinctive jacket, this motorcycle jacket, when he stormed the Capitol, which was sort of surprising because, you know, you wouldn't imagine someone who lived a couple blocks from the Capitol getting sucked into this, but he was just sort of in that conspiracy world and had posted things about, you know, the election and being stolen, was a big sort of COVID denier. And so he had, you know, even done an interview, I think a man on the street interview the day after January 6th, talking with a reporter about how he was on the steps. Didn't say he was inside, of course, but he was really deep in the Capitol, and they used facial recognition initially with that hit. And then found all this confirming information, including the jacket. And then there's another individual who's actually the webmaster of a county GOP over in Washington State. And for some reason, it took a very long time for that arrest to come about. And the way it actually came about was because this individual, Taylor Toronto, had heard about videos from being offered the opportunity to view January 6th videos that former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy had sort of opened that process up. So he came to D.C., came twice, in fact, and then he came back again and was hanging out with other January 6th supporters by the D.C. jail, who were even like some of those supporters even were pretty creeped out by this guy. He was just a little bit off. And then Donald Trump posted a Truth Social message that included Barack Obama's home address, at which point the next day after he posted that, Taylor Toronto shows up. And apparently they had been sort of monitoring him and were trying to get him arrested. But then there was a bolo out for him and like he was arrested. He was like running into the woods looking for tunnels to get into Obama's.
He had guns,
in, he had guns in his van.
In his van.
Right, yeah. And was like live streaming himself the whole time. So that was an arrest that could have been made though like almost a full 2 years earlier, and it was unclear. And the craziest part of it was when his co-defendant in the civil suit that was filed before any of these criminal charges came about was actually sentenced. I'm sitting in the back row and all of a sudden the door swings open and Taylor Toronto walks in and it was just this another one of those sort of things where you just like, you can't write this. And, you know, and this was before he went to Obama's house, but he was there and he was doing something on his phone. So the marshals eventually sort of like pulled him out and he identified himself by name. Right. So there was just like no mystery here. But, you know, the marshals don't know who this guy was, didn't realize, you know, what had happened there. And there was no warrant out for his arrest at that point.
Wow. So despite the impression I've given listeners so far, the book actually goes about 200 pages before you get to the Sedition Hunters. And so it actually has a very ambitious scope, the book. I wondered, what was your working title? Did you know all along it was going to be the Sedition Hunters?
Yeah, we discussed other titles afterwards, but my working title had always been Sedition Hunters. I think what sort of changed during the writing process was, frankly, I thought that the January 6th committee, as good work as they did sort of focusing, I think, in getting the nation to understand what Donald Trump had done and that sort of thing, there was a lot of work that was left on the table in terms of the law enforcement failures. And from what we understand from talking to, you know, committee staffers and whatnot, it's because they were worried that would distract from the underlining core message. And, you know, Liz Cheney especially and the Democrats were very much so about focusing on Trump. And I think that that was a missed opportunity in terms of examining what took place in the lead up to January 6th. And so there was a lot of this raw material that I just felt like wasn't fully explored. And even just going through it myself, when I was doing the reporting on this, I just learned a ton of stuff that I didn't know because I went through, you know, thousands of pages of FBI documents that have been turned over via FOIA, a lot of the interviews, the raw materials from the January 6th committee that were turned over. Thankfully, that was all made public, although not as closely examined. So it really, I thought, was important to sort of lay out why domestic terrorism is such a trickier issue for the Justice Department and for the FBI, what the sort of political reality was in the lead up to the attack, basically explaining how could we get in this situation. Because especially when you see all of these conspiracy theories now floating out there in the world, like I think the constant thing that I come back to is you're just wildly overestimating the powers or the abilities of federal bureaucracy sometimes. And I think that sometimes just like pulling people back to just like the daily, you know, sort of just work that goes into this and just the bureaucracy that sort of weighs a lot of this down can like get us back to a more reality-centered place, hopefully, if you realize that, like, no, there's not some grand conspiracy with, like, this one guy, Ray Epps, who, like, started all of this. It's just, like, it's explained by the bureaucracy. Why bureaucracy is usually the answer. Mm. And it's not to say, like, this is the Lawfare podcast, I should say. It's not to say there are not great people working in government, but the bureaucracy is a real issue here and a real thing that is holding, I think, holding back a lot of the government's work here.
You mention a 2009 Department of Homeland Security study, and it sort of, for me, encapsulated some of the problems that were encountered.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Yeah. So this was like early Obama era came out, and like it got in this memo from DHS that got vetted at a bunch of levels, and it basically just laid out like, you know, here's the reality: first black president. There's a lot of people who are angry about that. Military veterans might sort of be a threat, something, you know, that extremists could recruit from military veterans, and like it's sort of stuff.
Right wing extremists.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like this could be a real issue, and it's a threat. And like now it's like, duh, like, right? like it's been completely proven correct by like, I mean, just look at the statistics of the people who stormed the Capitol, and like military veterans are way out, not, you know, overrepresented in that group. You have a lot of people who really hooked on to this sort of, you know, patriotism narrative and 1776 and taking back the country that just comes up in all of the, you know, again and again and again and again. And so it was amazing how quickly the Obama administration caved on that, even though it was sort of it shouldn't have been controversial. It was just sort of laying out the facts, and it's been proven right by history. But they caved very quickly because you saw a lot of these attacks from the right wing. And I think that, you know, there's this real hesitancy to speak plainly about the threat, and there's this real hesitancy to sort of create these false equivalencies. And the moment that really crystallized that for me was when the head of the Washington Field Office for the FBI, the head of the intelligence division for the Washington Field Office for the FBI, was being asked about the threats in the lead up to January 6th. And she, you know, eventually conceded, yeah, we were seeing a lot more rhetoric in the lead up to January 6th. And then they start to ask the next question, and she just interjects very quickly on both sides. And to me, it was like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, there were not Joe Biden supporters like plotting to storm the Capitol to like, it just didn't compute. Like I wish there was a follow up question on this. Like, explain, like, what are you talking about? What are Democrats threatening about January 6th? Like, they're certifying the election that Joe Biden won. So it just doesn't make a lot of logical sense that they would be – that there would be a bunch of threats in that era.
You had a quotation from one guy. I forget his position, but he said, so there wasn't a lot of credible specific threats, but there was a vast amount of non-credible, unspecific threats, and that should have prompted something,
yeah.
Right? And I think that really encapsulated – some of the challenge and some of the missed opportunity.
It was the volume that really stood out there. And I think that's the problem, is that they were approaching like, okay, what's the enumerated violation of a federal criminal statute in particular instance? And how would we charge this? And have we charged it before when in like, you know, or they sort of were doing these as one-offs, and they would send out somebody to talk to a threat actor or something, right? So they would just send someone out to investigate someone who got sort of labeled in the domestic extremism realm, who was making threats. And okay, sure, you're stopping that one person, but like that's like killing an ant, right? Yeah. Like it's not like, okay, congrats, yeah. Right? Like it's just not like, that's not what the issue is. The issue was the volume, and then also the fact that this was all emanating ultimately from the White House, who was telling them the people like, and they just couldn't be honest about that in terms of like saying like, okay, the president's filling a bunch of people's heads with lies. Like, cut out the crap, cut out the in between. It's like a lot of people believe an insane conspiracy theory, and some of them might do something about that.
Yeah. It's a national security threat being caused by the president.
Right.
And that's sort of a...
Who wants to write that memo?
Nobody. Yeah. Yeah. And then the subtitle of the book is How January 6th Broke the Justice System. And what do you mean by that?
I think the volume has really... I should say, of course, the justice system thus far, I think, has done a good job of we've gotten these huge seditious conspiracy cases off the books. That's obviously a huge win. But I think just like the volume is going to defeat them here. We're not going to get to a situation where they're going to charge all of these people. It's a question of whether or not they will get all of the violent actors. And even then, you've sort of seen, you know, it's been undermined. We've had these people from within the FBI now make these themselves sort of these mini media moguls by complaining about January 6th cases. And, I think that it's a tough situation for any system to handle, just the volume of these cases that are going through. And it's just not always the in individual cases, I think that that has been very successful, but it's not sort of this cure-all for the political ills of the country. It's not as though like the justice system is always going to work in terms of like holding the line. There are broader issues here that, you know, I think that have come up that a court system and the justice system are not really equipped to fix ultimately.
You have some incredible anecdotes in the book that sort of they just illustrate something that goes beyond the specifics. And one of them is this moment where the QAnon shaman, it's after 4:17 p.m., you know, after Trump sends out the video saying, go, you need to go home. You're beautiful. You know, we love you, but you need to go home. And so the QAnon shaman is leaving. And there's a woman that won't believe that it's his voice. And
Donald Trump's voice, yeah.
And QAnon Shaman is the voice of reason saying, it's a effing video, you know. And she's saying, it doesn't sound like his video. It doesn't sound like his voice. I think it's pre-recorded, you know. And it just captures who these people were, yeah.
Then, like, that's when you have like, – and I think it was even one of the officers who was charged Shane Lamond. One of his communications was like talking about like when Alex Jones is the voice of reason. Because that was the situation where Alex Jones was like the one, okay, guys, like, right? Yep. Like, it's like, it reminds me of that meme. It's like, you know, we're all trying to find the guy who did this, you know? Like, it's like, that's right. You know, you see the consequences of his, of like years of action, you know, build up to this moment where just there's no trust in institutions. There's no trust in the media, and people are willing to believe these sort of bizarre conspiracy theories that have sprung up online.
And there's another very disturbing little anecdote, which is the a new Stop the Steal group opens on Facebook using a video of the angry mob at the Detroit TCF Center where, you know, supposedly where I guess Kelly Sorrell had reported back that, you know, a van carrying video equipment arrived and she decided that it was a van full of stolen or, you know, fabricated ballots. But it created a Facebook group that gathered 320,000 members in 22 hours.
Yeah.
It's
incredible. The trajectory of these groups was just like wild. They really did take off like wildfire. I think that the TCF Center was just really illustrative to me because I ended up I watched a lot of these at the time, but then for the book, I ended up going back and sort of watching as much of this video as I could. And it was just like everyone was so geared up to, like, that there was just fraud happening there. And I think that we don't speak as clearly as we should about just like the underlying just racism that's all – this is all built off of, because that's what it was. It was like, right, you know, no one had to question what Donald Trump was saying when he was talking about certain areas in 2016. It's all built upon this idea that there's just like massive criminality at, right, you know, urban or however they describe them, polling places. And, you know, logistically, that's just not that. If you just look at history, you look at all the studies, like there's not, this is, it's not, it's not a crime that has tremendous amount of personal benefits immediately. Like, just like, why would you commit a crime that like you don't even know what the impact of that would be on the other end, if it's even going to impact the race, especially for a race like president? The voter fraud schemes that we have seen have always been about these like really local races. It just doesn't make a lot of sense that you're able to like steal an election like on that scale, because the numbers just don't get you there and you're not even sure what state's going to matter. So anyway, this underlying assumption of criminality has really been, I think, an issue. And you really saw that playing out in Detroit, because there were a bunch of people who just went in there and were like looking over people's backs and just like looking for criminality everywhere. And in reality, they were just like, you know, suburbanites who had never been to the city before, or like were never – right, and like were hanging out with people they were uncomfortable around, and just got very, you know, sort of ginned up on a lot of that. And some of the – I mean, the complaints, the way that they were worded, it was like – you know, a man wearing a Black Lives Matter shirt of intimidating size, and just like almost sort of, it was like parody. Like one woman pointed out, like she literally didn't write that just she was a pregnant woman. She wrote that she was a pregnant white woman, like as though that was like some factor. And it's like, what are you? It was just very strange that like how this all played out. And I think you saw that anger sort of breaking through where it was like they thought that they were going to win. They thought that anyone voting in these cities was like was a cheater or a liar or something. So it just fed this really nasty and racist dynamic.
I think there were two strains. There was Giuliani's was the racist strain. You know, it was Philadelphia, Detroit, Fulton County, Milwaukee. And then there was the Sidney Powell sort of tin hat strain. And and actually the tin hat one, because it was through Dominion, could
anywhere
reach the whole country.
Right.
So, yeah, you had these two strains.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, I mean, just bizarre when you look back at some of this stuff. And like the thing that I think doesn't really break through to people, and you wished it at the time, because this is even something Bill Barr brought up to Donald Trump after the election, is that like you look at Philly, Donald Trump did better in Philly. He did better in Detroit than he did in 2016.
Yeah.
It's the suburbs where like that's what changed, right? He was more, you know, that was he bettered his numbers in the cities than he did in the suburbs.
Well, I'll give you one last chance here. Is there something I haven't asked you about you wish I had?
Yeah. I mean, I think that like I learned a lot doing, I think, writing this book, and especially about the lead up to January 6th. And, you know, so if I learned something, I hope other people will as well.
I learned a ton.
It's, yeah.
We're going to have to leave it here. But thank you, Ryan. It's a great book. It's a great accomplishment. I hope you're proud. Hope your mother's proud.
Thanks.
And
so much.
Thank you again.
Thanks so much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patchahow, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.